From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
It looks increasingly likely that we will have a black senator in Congress in this next session. There seems to be nothing to stop him.
Barack Obama, the Democratic nominee for U.S. Senate, could become the fifth black senator in U.S. history. We'll speak with longtime Chicago columnist Salim Wakil about the November election and why Obama was chosen to deliver this year's keynote address at the Democratic National Convention. And we go to Canada to speak with conscientious objector Jeremy Hinsman about his decision to become the first U.S. soldier to file for refugee status in Canada for refusing to fight in Iraq.
I may not be a policy maker, but in light of how the folks from the trailer park were scapegoated, I felt I had no other choice but to make the decision I did.
And we go to Bangkok to the International Conference on AIDS. We'll speak with Congressmember Barbara Lee, the only member of Congress to attend the conference, and we'll speak with others on the ground. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, Senate Republicans fell short in an attempt yesterday to change the country's constitution by adding an amendment that would ban same-sex marriage. Republicans didn't even have enough votes to bring the measure, which President Bush had endorsed, to a vote on the floor. Democrats defeated the move 50-48 in a procedural vote, 12 short of the supermajority needed for it to move on to a floor vote. The Washington-based newspaper The Hill is reporting that House Republicans are now looking for other ways to ban same-sex marriage. Options include stripping federal courts of jurisdiction over the issue, passing a federal law to define marriage, and using the appropriations process to ban gay marriage in Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, in Albany, New York, a judge Tuesday dismissed criminal charges against two Unitarian Universalist ministers who were arrested for marrying 13 same-sex couples in March. In her ruling, the judge questioned the legality of New York's ban on same-sex marriage. In Iraq, 10 people were killed, including 3 police officers, in a car bombing earlier today in the town of Haditha, west of Baghdad. This marks the second major car bombing in 2 days. In the north, a pipeline connecting the oil fields of Kirkuk and the Turkish port of Ceyhan has been attacked and set ablaze. Meanwhile, yesterday marked the bloodiest day in Iraq since the so-called handover of power. In Baghdad, the death toll of the massive car bomb outside the Iraqi government offices reached as high as 12. Near Mosul, the provincial governor was killed along with 2 bodyguards. He was the highest-ranking official to be assassinated so far this month. In Ramadi, at least 3 Iraqis died after a U.S. convoy came under attack. On the campaign trail, President Bush said yesterday the country needs to vote for him in November because work still has to be done in Iraq and Afghanistan. He said, quote, "I need 4 more years to complete the work. There's more to do to make America a safer place," the president said. He said there's more to do to make the world a more peaceful place. The Washington Post reporting the Bush administration is struggling to keep countries in the so-called coalition from pulling out of Iraq. The Philippines has already begun pulling out its troops. Norway has quietly removed its 155 military engineers, leaving behind only 15 people. New Zealand plans to pull its engineers out by September. Thailand also plans a September pullout, and the Netherlands is likely to pull out next spring. Spain, Honduras, and the Dominican Republic have already pulled their troops. Other countries have reduced their presence. Moldova now has 12 people in Iraq, down from 42. Singapore has 33, down from 191. There are some exceptions. South Korea has announced it will increase its force from 600 to 3,700, and Georgia plans to more than double the number of troops it has from about 150 to 400. The U.S. currently has about 140,000 troops stationed in Iraq. In October, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld dismissed critics who claimed the Iraq invasion was largely a U.S. effort. He said behind the Iraq occupation was, quote, one of the largest coalitions in the history of mankind. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees is reporting an Israeli tank shot at one of its convoys as it attempted to deliver food in northern Gaza yesterday. The UN was bringing flour, oil, lentils, sugar, rice, and milk to the Palestinian town of Beit Hanun, which was cut off by Israeli troops from the rest of Gaza over 2 weeks ago. The government announced yesterday it's dismantling a controversial airline passenger screening system called CAPS-2, which would have assigned every passenger a color-coded threat level. Under the plan, security officials would have collected detailed personal information about every passenger from public and private databases to determine how much of a threat the passenger posed. Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge said yesterday the system is being canned because of privacy issues. Under the system, a red rating would mean the passenger would not be allowed to fly. Yellow would mean extra security at the airport. Green would mean a trip through regular security. President Bush is expected to soon nominate a California man with ties to the defense investment firm Carlyle Group to serve as the Secretary of the Army, the Army's most senior civilian post. Francis Harvey, who's the former chief operating officer for a division of military contractor Westinghouse Electric, now serves on the boards of two Carlyle-affiliated firms. The Carlyle Group has deep ties to the Bush family, former Pentagon leaders, and the Saudi royal family. President Bush used to head up a Carlyle-owned business, and his father served as an advisor. Osama bin Laden's family has been among the Saudi investors who helped Carlyle grow into a major military investment firm. A Senate investigation has found that the Riggs Bank courted business from former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet in 1996 and helped him hide up to $8 million while he was under house arrest in Britain. This according to a report in the Washington Post. The Post also reports the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee is probing 150 Saudi Arabian accounts as part of an investigation into terrorist funding. The revelation comes just months after the Riggs Bank was forced to pay $25 million in penalties for violating money laundering laws in dealing with the embassies of Saudi Arabia and Equatorial Guinea. And the diet company SlimFast has dropped Whoopi Goldberg from its ads just days after she appeared at Carrie Edwards' fundraiser and made fun of President Bush's name.
Oh, le sida, une terrible maladie. Le sida, un mal qui ne pardonne pas. Le sida, un mal qui n'épargne personne. Oh, ce fléau, le sida, qui laisse impuissante la médecine. Si solo mama. Si te bomelinga li pala mama. Si te panzelinga fami mama.
Atención Nacida, a 1987 recording by the Congolese musician Franco. The song translates in English into Beware of AIDS. Franco was one of the first major African stars to warn about the AIDS epidemic. He died 2 years later at the age of 51, allegedly of AIDS. We'll be going to Bangkok later in the program to the International AIDS Conference, but right now to Canada. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Since October 2001, when the U.S. began its massive attack on Afghanistan as part of the Bush administration's so-called war on terror, Democracy Now! Has spent extensive time airing the voices of military families, of soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, and documenting the stories of the soldiers, like Camilo Mejia, who have refused to fight in a war they consider illegal or immoral. Today, we hear another of these stories. This is how independent journalist Patrick O'Neill tells it. On December 20th, 2003, Jeremy Hinsman, a U.S. Army specialist stationed at Fort Bragg, got the news he had dreaded. His unit, the 504th Brigade, 2nd Battalion, would be shipping out to Iraq shortly after the new year for an indefinite deployment in the war on terror. Last year, Hinsman, who is the father of a one-year-old son, was deployed for more than 8 months to Afghanistan. When he left, Hinsman's son, Liam, was just 7 months old. When Hinsman returned, Liam was walking and didn't remember his father. While he didn't see any combat in that first deployment, Hinsman said he'd a bad feeling about going to Iraq. In Iraq, Hinsman said he felt like he would have to do some things he would regret. His application for conscientious objector status was rejected by the military. During Christmas leave, Hinsman and his wife discussed their options. He could go to Iraq, an option both he and his wife rejected. He could refuse the deployment order and face court-martial and likely a prison term. Or he could follow a plan of action that thousands of young men like himself had taken during the Vietnam War. He could flee to Canada. Option three was a go, and on January 2nd, Jeremy Hinsman and his family packed up their small car with a few essentials, leaving almost all of their possessions behind. They left under the cover of darkness for the 17-hour drive to the U.S.-Canada border. Quakers living in the U.S. made contacts in Ontario, and the family was set up with places to stay until they moved into a Toronto apartment on February 1st. Jeremy Hinsman is believed to be the first U.S. soldier to file for refugee status in Canada for refusing to fight in Iraq. Soon, another soldier, 19-year-old Brandon Huey, followed him and fled to Canada. Some say this is the first echo of the 12,000 deserters and 20,000 draft resistors who went north more than 30 years ago to escape the Vietnam War. Last Wednesday, Jeremy Hinsman appeared before Canada's Immigration and Refugee Board, known as the IRB, in Toronto, supported by Brandon Huey. The board set a hearing date for Jeremy Hinsman in late October. He now joins us on the line. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about how you made your decision?
Pretty much what it came down to was, I won't go into the false pretenses and everything that we know about, but it, being in a legal war, I would be being complicit in a criminal enterprise. And you may say that, oh, well, you're not a policymaker or a general or whatever, that the Nuremberg principles wouldn't apply to you. But, I mean, in light of what's happened since Abu Ghraib, when they scapegoated like the lower enlisted soldiers for simply carrying out what the policy was from the upper echelons, I think it's pretty fair to say that we made the right decision, because I was in the infantry, and there's a good chance that I would have been pretty active in a negative way, and so that's why we came here. Pretty much is that I don't want to shoot people. I would have been happy to go to Iraq, porta potty janitor or Operation Human Shield. I just don't want to shoot people.
Can you talk about your application as a conscientious objector here in the United States that was rejected? On what grounds was it objected, and what did you tell them?
I applied for a conscientious objector status in August of 2002. When I initially submitted the application, I was almost immediately reassigned to duties commensurate with what I stated in the application until it could be evaluated. Then, and also at that time, I'd like to add that we didn't know we were being deployed anywhere. So 3 months later on Halloween, my first sergeant, the same person I gave the application to, looks at me with this sparkle in his eye, and he's like, "Well, Hinsman, you're a conscientious objector. We need the paperwork." And at that point, we had known for about 2 weeks that we were being deployed. So I had to resubmit it on the eve of a deployment. And to a third party who didn't know the history of it or whatever, of course, my motives fell under a cloud of suspicion. And in the hearing, I was asked a hypothetical question, being, "What if your camp was attacked? What would you do?" And when we left for Afghanistan, I was given an M4 with a scope and an infrared laser and everything. And I asked, "Well, why do I have this? I'm a conscientious objector. I mean, I don't want to shoot anybody." And they said, "Well, you have the inherent right to self-defense," and yada, yada, yada. So in the hearing, they said, "Well, what would you do if we're attacked?" And I said, "Well, given the context I'm in, and being that I'm human and I can probably overcome my fight instinct, I'd probably shoot back. I mean, I'd really not rather be in that position, but if someone broke into my house, I might, you know, make efforts to restrain them. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to use the same logic to be a premeditated murderer, which is what we do in the infantry, for better or worse. You don't just go on a raid one day. You rehearse it for 3 or 4 days in advance, and over and over again." And so in the summation, the investigating officer stated that there was no difference between defensive and offensive operations, and combat is combat, and therefore I'm not a conscientious objector. However, if I had said, "No, I'll go hide in a hole," I would have been shirking my responsibilities as a soldier and found to be negligent in my duties, and that would have been a whole nother episode. So it was kind of a no-win question. So I had to answer it honestly, which I'm not ashamed of doing.
Jeremy Hinsman, can you describe your experience in Afghanistan?
Yeah, it was pretty mundane. When I was there, because I had a conscientious objector application pending, I did dishes for a few months until Kelly Brown and Root employees took over, which is a Halliburton subsidiary, as you probably know. And then, so I had a presence there, and then I was made a cook. And prior to that, I had worked long, long days, 7 days a week, which was, whether or not it was punishment for what I did, I had dug my own hole, so I didn't really have a problem with it. I wasn't going on combat operations. So then I was made a cook for a few months, and life got a little easier. I had like a day off once a week. I only worked 12 hours a day as opposed to 16. And then that was unbeknownst to my first sergeant, and he came in one day on my day off and stated that I wasn't a cook. I was there to scrub floors and do whatever, and so I resumed my tedium. But again, I had dug the hole, so whatever. But as far as seeing much of the country, I didn't. I was in Kandahar, and the furthest I left was a couple hundred yards out of the camp to dump garbage out. And in fact, I often thought that I could have flown around in a C-17 for 31 hours and landed in the middle of Utah, and I wouldn't have known the difference, because the landscape was quite similar.
Why did you join the military?
Yeah, that's a $64,000 question. I mean, for the reasons that most people do, I would say. I come from a fairly working class background, and I didn't have the means to attend university without becoming saddled with debt. And so when you have $50,000 dangled in front of you, it's enticing. But also, I wanted to be a part of something that transcended myself, I guess. I didn't really just want to go to work and just earn money for earning money's sake. It seemed kind of meaningless to me. And also, I was at the point in my life where I was looking for some focus and structure and whatnot. So I joined, and I chose the infantry. I wasn't assigned to it. And I guess I wasn't naive as to what the infantry does. I mean, you go shoot things and whatever. But I guess what I wasn't quite aware of was what a inhibition I would have to the taking of life. I mean, I knew that that's what we did, but I didn't realize how many barriers would have to be overcome and how they would have to be overcome.
What has been the response of the press, both here and in Canada? You spoke out at an anti-war rally in Canada.
I did, and at an anti-war rally, I mean, of course, the reception was warm. I haven't seen a lot of U.S. media. I know about Hare O'Reilly's campaign on Fox to boycott Canadian products or whatever, if we're allowed to stay, or even now if they don't extradite us, which is whatever. I wouldn't give them the time of day. But it's pretty evenly divided in Canada. I mean, it's a diverse country, and I'm sure half the people would say send them back on the next bus, but there has been a lot of support as well. Whether I like it or not, I think this case is kind of becoming perhaps a microcosm for Canadian sovereignty, because what's at stake in our case is, and it's to be ruled on before the hearing starts, but whether or not the legality of the war in Iraq is relevant to my case. And the Canadian government intervened, which they don't usually do in refugee cases, to say that the legality is irrelevant. Well, that's the whole reason we're here, is because the war was illegal.
What about what's been described as a kind of underground railroad? We certainly saw it in Vietnam, but now to help you go up to Canada.
I think that would be an overstatement at this point. I think if we're allowed to stay, it may set a precedent, at least for this era. And I think it'd be safe to say that a lot more people would come. But I think that's what Canada's trying to avoid. Because if they have to say that, oh, the war was legal and Hinsman should have to go home, then the U.S. is going to be like, well, why didn't you send troops? But the more likely scenario is they're going to have to actually state their opinion on the war, which they didn't do. I mean, they didn't send troops because the Canadian people didn't want to go, but also because they probably had some legal opinion in Ottawa saying that the war was illegal, and they're going to have to state that. And that's obviously going to drive a nail between Canada and the U.S., and they're trying to avoid that. And I don't blame them. I mean, in a sense, it's not an enviable position to be in as a government. But at the same time, they are their own sovereign country, and they shouldn't be ashamed of what they do.
Finally, what was it like for you to cross the border after your 17-hour ride?
As dramatic as Patrick may make it seem in the story, it wasn't really a Canadian border security. It wasn't a big deal. I mean, they didn't ask for our ID. They said, what are we doing in Canada? We said, we're visiting friends, which was a play on words, considering our involvement with the Quakers for the last few years. And we just drove through. And, of course, in a sense, the load was off because you never know what's going to happen at a border crossing, however innocuous it may be. But it wasn't a big deal, but I mean, it was kind of a load off, at least for the day.
Jeremy Hinsman, I want to thank you for being with us. What is your website?
www.jeremyhinsman.net, I believe.
thank you for talking to us from Canada. Jeremy Hinsman talking about his decision to become the first U.S. soldier to file for refugee status in Canada for refusing to fight in Iraq. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about the man who's been chosen as the keynote for the Democratic National Convention, could become the fifth black senator in U.S. history. Stay with us. The young blood started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of vengeance in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big whore. To the wars, always the young to fall. Now look how we won with a saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. Phil Oakes singing I Ain't Marching Anymore. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. The Kerry campaign has announced Illinois State Senator and Democratic nominee for the U.S. Senate, Barack Obama, will deliver the keynote address at this year's Democratic National Convention. In its press release, the Kerry campaign said, quote, more African Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans, and Hispanics will attend the convention than ever before. The announcement came on the same day the Democrats launched a $2 million ad campaign on television, radio, and newspapers targeting black voters. Barack Obama's father is from Kenya. He met Obama's mother, who's white, when both were students at the University of Hawaii. When Obama was two, his father left the family, returned to Kenya, where he eventually became a senior economist in the Ministry of Finance. Obama was raised mostly in Kansas by his mother and grandparents. He graduated from Columbia University and received a law degree from Harvard Law School. He became the first black president of the prestigious Harvard Law Review and later worked as a civil rights lawyer and as a community organizer in New York and Chicago. He currently teaches law at the University of Chicago, has served in the state Senate since 1997. Obama currently faces no known opponent in the November election. Republican Jack Ryan dropped out last month over embarrassing allegations in his divorce papers that he took his wife to sex clubs before they split up against her will. Nearly 3 weeks later, GOP leaders are still searching for a replacement. The possibility that former Chicago Bears coach Mike Ditka would join the race faded last night when he decided not to seek the party's nomination. If elected, Obama would become only the fifth black U.S. senator in the history of this country. We go now to Salim Wakil. He is senior editor in These Times, he also does a weekly op-ed column for the Chicago Tribune. We welcome you, Salim, back to Democracy Now!
Amy, good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you. So tell us more about Barack Obama.
Well, he's an extremely attractive candidate. You gave the biographical details, and aside from those, he's also unflinchingly progressive in a state that looks at progressives in a kind of, I guess you could say, schizophrenic way. I mean, you have people like Paul Simon, who was generally the late Paul Simon, who was one of the state's most respected politicians, who was also unstintingly liberal, but he was from a downstate district where voters are generally more conservative. And Obama has managed to appeal to this wide range of voters in much the same way that Simon did. He also has very strong support in the African-American community, which was really long in coming. A lot of people had doubts about him. They thought he was one of these kind of, you know, these new mold black politicians who downplay racial issues and civil rights modalities and interests. But he doesn't do that. He speaks forthrightly about racial issues and has, you know, a great deal of history and experience in civil rights oriented kind of struggles. So he in many ways he breaks that mold of the black politician who really softens his message to the point of homogeneity in order to appeal to a wide range. He holds on to his message and still appeals to this wide range of constituents. Much of it is his just natural charisma. He's a very charismatic speaker. He comes across as being at ease and non-threatening to people who may differ from his political positions. He speaks before a wide variety of constituents. He seems to be willing to talk to people in ways that don't necessarily flatter them. I mean, he speaks truths. For example, he will speak before a Jewish audience and talk about his problems with Israeli policy in a way that inspires trust rather than the kind of disagreement that you often find when that happens. So he's one of these rare figures, political figures, who has a kind of a fire in their belly that he doesn't have to really manifest in any histrionic way. He's a very calm person, and yet you can see that he's deeply committed to certain issues of social justice and civil rights.
So you were there on March 16th at the Hyatt Hotel in Chicago when it was announced he'd won the primary?
Yes, I was there, and I made the point in a piece that particular rally that night reminded me so much of 1983 when Harold Washington won the primary for mayor of Chicago. The same kind of racially diverse crowd and each element of that diversity was equally enthusiastic about him. He inspires trust. He's really a rare political figure, and I've known him for quite a while. I've been following his career even before he went into the state senate. You kind of know when you encounter him that he's meant for some serious positions. He's just a unique figure. He really is.
Can you talk about the political landscape of Illinois and the seat that he would be taking over? The fading prospect that the famed football coach Ditka would be the Republican candidate. What the Republicans will do now?
It's really hard. It's really hard to say. They've been, you know, their hopes have been dashed so frequently in the last few months. Ditka, of course, was fascinating. As one of the columnists said, he was fascinating because, just as a floating object is fascinating to a drowning person. They're looking for someone to give them at least the hint of a chance in November, because Barack beat seven candidates in the primary, and he won with 53% of the vote, which was extraordinary, completely confounding all of the pundits' predictions. Although they thought he would win, but not by such an overwhelming margin. And his appeal was quite Catholic across all segments of the population. His first opponent, who they thought would win, a guy named Blair Hall, who's a billionaire, they say, in the Chicago area. He also had problems with his divorce records. So Blair Hall, after his divorce records came out, it revealed that he had There was some allegations that he had actually physically assaulted his wife, and so his star dropped immediately. And just, you know, and ironically, that same problem afflicted his major, the one who eventually won the Republican primary, Jack Ryan, who was in many ways a very appealing candidate. Jack Ryan was someone who, you know, deserted corporate life to teach in an inner city high school, a very well regarded inner city high school, and he had a lot of black supporters. So he was an unusual Republican candidate who posed he could have been a very powerful opponent because of his own personal story. And when he dropped out of the race, the Republicans were left without anything at all, and so they began grasping for straws, and now they're still grasping after Ditka decided to bow out.
And Obama's family, his wife and his children?
Obama's wife is Michelle, who herself is quite a powerhouse. She's in many ways his campaign manager, and he has two children who are, you know, obviously two young kids are acute additions to any campaign, as we're finding out with Edward's kids in the presidential campaign. And he has a very appealing family. He lives in Hyde Park, a few doors down from me, as a matter of fact. And he's the family man. He's the committed civil rights activist. He's the intellectual. He graduated from Harvard. He was the first African American, or the first black president of Harvard Law Review. And he has an intellectual aura about him, as well as a kind of down to earth aura.
What has his stance been on the invasion of Iraq?
He's been very, very forthright in his opposition to the war. He spoke in 2000 at a anti-war rally in October, I think 2002. Very well attended, very, very large rally, and he said some powerful words that were strongly against the war. And I think he gained a lot of supporters from that particular speech. He was so clear in his opposition, and yet not in any way negative. He didn't use the, you know, traditional kinds of cold words that people who oppose the war were using. He did it in a way that attracted people who normally would be gung-ho for military action. He said he wasn't against all wars, and he kind of went against much of what was being said on the podium, but he did it in such a considered and intelligent way that even those who wanted, you know, more raw meat were satisfied with his speech, and in fact were captivated by the way he presented himself.
Finally, what are the major positions he has taken outside of the invasion of Iraq and his being critical of what's going on now in the occupied territories in West Bank and Gaza?
Well, he's I think, in my mind, his most significant significant contribution has been his legislative battles against the death penalty, against the criminal justice system. You know, in Illinois, it's been a series of shocking exonerations, you know, of innocent people who were on death row. So he was involved very intimately in drafting and passing legislation that requires the videotaping of police interrogations and confessions in all capital cases. And he was one of the co-sponsors of this very comprehensive reform of the death penalty system in Illinois, which many people say may kind of trigger the retreat on the death penalty in many other states. I mean, he's
we have 30 seconds.
Jobs. He passed the legislation that provided tax breaks for investment in depressed areas, and education, early childhood education. He's a very strong advocate for that. he supports charter schools, but he's also a very strong advocate for public education. He's not in favor of vouchers. And his opposition is considered, and then once you hear it, you say, well, why didn't I think of that? You know, this man is putting it in such clear terms, it's hard to disagree.
Salim Mowakil.
Genuine star in the political firmament.
Well, I thank you very much for being with us. Salim Mowakil, talking about Barack Obama, who has been chosen as the keynote speaker at the Democratic National Convention in Boston. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Bangkok. Congressmember Barbara Lee is already on the line with us. Stay with us.
The matter serious now. This one will be joking. Is them for real? Now if you love yourself, you better protect yourself. Come, my brothers, listen to me. Come, my sisters, do you hear me?
Femi Kuti, Stop AIDS, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org, broadcasting on more than 240 stations around the country on Free Speech TV, Channel 9415, and we welcome Link TV, broadcasting on Channel 9410 on Dish Network and Channel 375 on DirecTV. Starting the broadcast yesterday. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to Bangkok, as the International AIDS Conference in Bangkok wraps up, the United States is facing sharp criticism for its funding policies, the small size of its delegation at the conference, and a lack of action to make generic AIDS medications available. Randall Tobias, head of President Bush's emergency plan for AIDS relief and former head of pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly, was disrupted by about 40 protesters during his speech yesterday. Tobias said, quote, perhaps the most critical mistake we can make is to allow this pandemic to divide us. Many conference participants criticize Bush's $15 billion plan because it prioritizes abstinence-based AIDS prevention, and only a small percentage of the money will go to the multilateral global fund to fight AIDS. The global conference has included extensive discussion of the so-called ABC prevention technique, which stands for abstain, be faithful, or use a condom, a method advocated by the Ugandan government and supported by U.S. Critics say condoms should not be a last resort because women around the world often do not have the option of abstinence. Two reports from UNAIDS released at the conference reveal AIDS prevention programs have yet to have a significant impact on the spread of the virus. Only 7% of those with HIV who need drugs to stay alive over the next 2 years are getting them. Generic AIDS drugs will be vital in closing the gap between infection and treatment. Doctors Without Borders presented data from projects in 21 developing countries at the conference showing that the controversial fixed-dose generic drug combinations to treat AIDS work just as well as patented medications. The treatment combines three antiretroviral drugs into one pill that patients must take twice a day. Fewer pills to take increases compliance, and generic drug production push the cost of these medications to $389 or less, a fraction of the cost of patented drugs. The Bush administration says it'll assist in providing generic drugs after the Food and Drug Administration approves these medications. This despite the fact the same drugs have already passed muster with the World Health Organization. And while this conference will likely serve as a benchmark for AIDS research and treatment, its impact may be limited by the absence of many U.S. scientists who planned to attend but were blocked by the Bush administration, by the Health and Human Services Administration. The U.S. sent about 230 scientists to the AIDS conference in Barcelona 2 years ago. This year, sent only 50 AIDS researchers. Observers speculated the move could be retribution from Secretary Tommy Thompson, who was heckled by activists during his speech in Barcelona. We turn first to Congressmember Barbara Lee. She has just returned from Bangkok. She was the only member of Congress to be at the International Conference on AIDS. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressmember Lee.
Good to be with you.
Can you talk about first the issue of the scientists?
You know, first let me say I participated in the Durban AIDS Conference several years ago, also Barcelona, where Tommy Thompson was with a much larger delegation, and now at this one in Bangkok. I think that it's, first of all, outrageous that the United States would not send its top scientists from the CDC and the NIH to participate in this conference, reducing the delegation, I believe, from about 236 to 50. Sends a terrible signal to the rest of the world. I mean, it says, one, that we really don't care about the science. Two, we don't need to talk to colleagues in the international community in terms of their insights and in terms of their scientific developments. And three, it's a real slap in the face, I think, to the world in terms of the largest industrialized, wealthiest country in the world, that should be leading this charge, reducing its efforts in international forums. And again, this is just another example of the go-it-alone Bush administration's unilateral kinds of efforts. And November can't come fast enough, I tell you, in terms of every policy, every effort that we're engaged in.
Congressmember Lee, we're also joined on the phone by McGill University Professor Mark Weinberg, former president of the International AIDS Society. The next International AIDS Conference will be held 2006 in Toronto, where he's from. Can you talk about the issue of retrovirals and the effect of not having the scientists in Bangkok, Professor Weinberg?
Well, first, I think we should point out that this conference in Bangkok has been a success. People have responded favorably, as they did in Durban 4 years ago, to the idea that these meetings should be held on alternating occasions in a developing country venue where the disease is so endemic. I think that there has also been a significant acceptance of the idea, as the Congresswoman pointed out, that we need to deliver drugs to people who need them so desperately, and the fact that the formulae that we now have to treat people seem to be working so well diminishes any rationale to not provide these drugs on an expeditious basis to people around the world who will die without them. In regard to the lack of a significant American presence here, it's true that we wish that there had been more top-flight American scientists, but I think it's fair to point out as well that there are many Americans who are participating in this conference. And, you know, there's an old saying, people vote with their feet. There are significant numbers of American scientists who have come here at their own expense. There are significant numbers of American scientists who have benefited from travel funds other than those provided by the United States government to come here and have made coming here a priority. And I think it would be a mistake to give the impression that Americans are not here, although certainly the numbers would have been much increased had the Bush administration made it possible for scientists from the NIH to come here using travel funds that would normally be available to such individuals through monies that are normally made available for this purpose through the research funding mechanisms.
We're also joined on the phone by Rachel Cohen, the U.S. liaison for Doctors Without Borders Campaign for Access to Essential Medicines, who's in Bangkok for the week for the International AIDS Conference. Now, a number of reports were put out. Doctors Without Borders presented data from projects in 21 developing countries at the conference, showing that the controversial fixed-dose generic drug combinations to treat AIDS works just as well as patented medicines. Can you explain that and its implications, Rachel?
Sure. First, thanks for having me. In fact, Doctors Without Borders today has over 13,000 people living with HIV on antiretroviral therapy in our various programs throughout the world, and we're working today in 25 countries to deliver antiretroviral treatment. One small retrospective study that we did basically showed that of those 13,000 patients that we have on treatment, roughly half, or over 6,000, are on the first-line fixed-dose combination of D4T, 3TC, and nevirapine. That drug, just to remind listeners, is only available from generic manufacturers. Why? Because the single ingredients, that is to say D4T produced by Bristol Myers Squibb, 3TC, which is produced by GlaxoSmithKline, and nevirapine, which is produced by Boehringer Ingelheim, hold the patents, and they have not managed to collaborate or have not overcome the various patent barriers that would keep them from combining those medicines into one. So, in fact, the innovation that has enabled us in large part to expand our treatment programs in resource-limited settings and to scale up the numbers of people on treatment in our programs is an innovation that has really only happened in the generic industry. The data is significant not because we didn't expect these outcomes. Frankly, we didn't feel such a study was necessary. What's important is the political context in which this meeting is happening and in which treatment scale-up is today taking place. And that is to say, the sort of misinformation that's being spread by the U.S. government, by the Bush administration, and by some others, including in the pharmaceutical industry, about the quality, safety, and efficacy of generic medicines, and in particular those fixed-dose combinations that I mentioned. I want to really emphasize why the fixed-dose combinations are important. First, if a person has to take the brand-name pills on their own, the single drugs, they have to take six pills a day. With fixed-dose combinations, our patients are taking one pill in the morning and one pill in the evening. Simplifying treatment regimens reduces the risk of resistance because you can't take partial doses of these drugs. It promotes adherence because these pills, simply speaking, are easier to take. It eases supply chain management, which makes procurement and drug supply management easier because there are simply fewer pills. And importantly, this combination is available for as little as $140 per person per year. The brand name equivalent is, for the best available price worldwide, is $562. So it's quite an increase if you have to shift to the brand name drugs. That's why these drugs are so important. But the clinical evidence that was presented at this conference is only important insofar as it demonstrates what the rest of the world has been saying for a long time, which is these generic medicines are safe, effective, and they're saving lives today. There's no reason to justify not promoting their wide-scale use in developing countries.
Rachel Cohen from Doctors Without Borders. Congressmember Barbara Lee, the whole issue of the Bush administration's emphasis on abstinence, can you talk about that?
Sure. The bill which we actually participated in writing that set up this abstinence-only 33% set-aside is a bill that that portion that we adamantly fought when the bill was being drafted. Of course, we didn't win that fight because of the composition of the House. This is, it doesn't make any sense, first of all, to have a 33% designation of funding for abstinence only. If you talk about a comprehensive strategy to address this pandemic, you're talking about abstinence, be faithful, and condom use, all three equal weighted. You can't take one out and designate 33% to the exclusion of others. Women, the new face of AIDS, of course, is with women, and oftentimes women do not have a choice in terms of abstaining, given the power relationships and given the issues of violence that women are dealing with. So minimally, we should provide for an adequate distribution and promotion of education as it relates to condoms. I am trying to repeal this provision. I introduced a bill last week with 54 co-sponsors that would say this 33% should not be government policy, that we should allow for the full comprehensive strategy if we're going to really begin to attack this pandemic. Abstinence only is not a scientifically proven method. Condom use is scientifically proven, and we need a comprehensive strategy that involves abstinence, be faithful, and condoms. Certainly, we teach our young people to delay their sexual debut. I mean, that's a given. That has nothing to do with the fact that millions of people around the world are sexually active, and to stop the spread of the disease, we do not need an abstinence-only policy, but we need a comprehensive effort. And so we're going to try to repeal this policy, and again, hopefully with the new administration, with the President Kerry, we will be able to eliminate and get rid of that policy. Let me just finally say that, you know, abstinence-only is the policy of our own country as it relates to our domestic education policy. Federal funds are not allowed for school districts that teach comprehensive sex education. And California actually denied, said we don't want to take the federal funding. We've lost close to $50 million because we teach comprehensive sex education in classes. But for the most part, the rest of the country has to teach abstinence only. And so, of course, I've introduced my Family Life Education Act with close to 100 co-sponsors that would say that states are eligible for federal funding if they choose to teach comprehensive sex education. It's up to them to decide what to do. So this abstinence-only policy is a very backwards policy. It doesn't make sense, and it's not scientifically proven.
Congressmember Lee speaking to us, just getting back from the 15th International Conference on AIDS in Bangkok, and we go there now to a member of the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa named Nathan Geffen. Can you talk about the U.S. policies on your country in South Africa?
Sorry, just a small correction. I'm not in Bangkok. I'm in Cape Town. Unfortunately, our Bangkok representative wasn't available. Yeah, there are very serious effects of the Bush administration's policy with regard to HIV. I think the Congress woman just pointed at some of them out very eloquently. For one of the problems is that by giving most of the money that the U.S. government has put aside for fighting the international HIV epidemic to PEPFAR instead of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, that is already a problem for us, because the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria is a multilateral independent institution which doesn't make decisions based on politics. It makes decisions based on what are the best proposals available for alleviating HIV, for alleviating TB, and for alleviating malaria. So all the baggage about, that comes with the whether we should be promoting condom use or not, or whether we should be promoting abstinence, or whether promoting reproductive rights is acceptable or not to the Bush administration, all that baggage falls away if the money is given to primarily to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria. The pseudo-moral agenda of the Bush administration in trying to dictate to other countries about whether they should be promoting the use of condoms or whether they should be promoting reproductive rights education really has no place in the funding of AIDS.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Nathan Geffen of the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa, Rachel Cohen of Doctors Without Borders Campaign for Access to Essential Medicines, Barbara Lee, the only member of the U.S. Congress who attended the International Conference on AIDS in Bangkok, and Professor Mark Weinberg, director of the McGill AIDS Center and chair of the committee organizing the next International AIDS Conference to be held in 2006 in Toronto. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, and Nell Geiser. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. The Exception to the Ruler's Book and Media Tour continues in Pittsburgh this Friday. Benefit for Pittsburgh Community Television at Carnegie Mellon University Center at 5000 Forbes Avenue. Then on Saturday, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, at the Civil Rights Symposium of the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Wyndham Hotel. On Wednesday, we'll be in Atlanta, Georgia, benefit for WRFG, Martin Luther King Jr. Chapel, Morehouse College, and on Friday, Provincetown, Massachusetts, a town hall with Norman Mailer. That does it for the show. Again, welcome to Link TV and Free Speech TV. Always, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.